Wow, look at him go. There goes Jerry the Happy Chipmunk. See him there, playing, dancing, and running in the woods? Boy, he sure looks chipper. Unfortunately, Jerry's got a little hang-up. You wouldn't be able to tell now, but Jerry has a drinking problem, and it won't be long before cirrhosis of the liver does old Jerry in. That leaves Jerry's woodland friends with a choice to make. What to do with Jerry's lifeless corpse? Do you feed him to the hawks? Do you toss him in a grimy pit in the ground? Do you light him on fire and scatter the ashes in the name of Destok, Lord of Destruction? Ha ha ha! Well, boys, you'd be wrong about all three, praise Destok. There's an even better way to make sure everyone remembers what a friendly, happy fellow Jerry was. Taxidermy. That's right, all you need is a needle and thread, some sculpting wire, and a 350 RPM defleshing machine, and you can make Jerry's good as new again. Some would say even better. It won't be long now before Jerry's right as rain, pretending to jump for joy with all his little forest friends. Go, Jerry, go! Hey everybody, this is InfoCast 5000.
And I'm your host, Sam Acuff.
Hey Sam, I'm Baron Malley.
I usually say this is InfoCast 5000.
I know, I switched it up on you.
Yeah,
We're trying to keep it up. This is the podcast where we dive into the history of things familiar to everybody. Join us as we try to figure out why everything exists.
And today we are talking about a topic that Baron was really, 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 really fucking excited about, taxidermy.
Well, you know, taxidermy is one of those things. I would say on a personal level, it has influenced my art.
What? What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
What's your art?
I guess morbidly beautiful is the best way to put that. And I think taxidermy falls into that category.
You're talking about your illustrations?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My art.
I don't know. You're a pretty complex guy. Anyway, yeah, we're talking about taxidermy. I handpicked refrigerators a couple weeks ago. Baron handpicked taxidermy this week. We're going with the ones that we've been wanting to do for a while. We're just having fun with it. So,
Been chopping at the bit for this one.
You have pushed for it for a while, and I was reluctant, but I'm happy now.
Let's
I think we did a great job.
Dead animals being posed as if they were alive.
Yes, yes. We've all probably taken the obligatory school trip to the Natural Science Museum, or at the very least have seen the stuffed head of some slain creature mounted on the wall of a dive bar or your lonely uncle's man cave. But have you ever wondered how those animals got there? Probably not. But now that you are, how did they get there? And how long have we been flaunting the corpses of the planet's less intelligent species like tchotchkes and exhibits for our youth? Well, over the next 2 weeks, we'll try and find out just how much of this practice is science, how much of it is art, and how much of it is just genuine depravity, if not just a little bit of all of the above. So join us as we try to figure out why taxidermy exists. So first of all, right at the top, we're going to start with the etymology. The word taxidermy comes from the Greek taxis, or arrangement, and derma, which means skin.
Or a skin quilt.
What?
A skin quilt?
Not quite. The article that I got this from somehow interpreted as skin art, but how I interpreted and many others interpret the translation to literally mean skin arrangement. Mm. So the arrangement of skin.
Right.
So we're starting off the episode, I think, on the right foot by saying right at the top, taxidermy translates to the art of the arrangement of skin.
And if you aren't horrified by this, then continue listening.
Yeah, no, we're going to get into it. This is from beginning to end. Taxidermy is weird. The first known taxidermists were, can you guess? The ancient Egyptians.
I was going to say George Bush.
No. No.
Oh. I know that now.
Besides Baron, is anyone surprised at this point? Like every episode we have kind of tends to start in the ancient Egyptians, which, you know, they were around for a very long time and they're very smart for an ancient civilization. So this shouldn't come as a shock to anyone. But as early as 2200 BC, they developed early forms of animal preservation using injections, spices, oils, and such. Obviously, you can relate this very closely to, if not literally, in the form of mummification. They were able to preserve the dogs, cats, monkeys, birds, and pretty much any pet that a pharaoh had, so they could bury them with the pharaohs in their tombs. They even managed to preserve one article I read said a hippopotamus, although other articles literally cited that they couldn't do things like a hippopotamus. So I think that that's a bit of a red herring or a myth in the taxidermy world, that the hippo is like used as a example of one or the other of what they could or couldn't do.
I would love to see a hippo mummy.
I wish I saw a picture of it, which leads me to think it doesn't exist, or maybe it just like wasn't much to look at.
Also would put a very more entertaining twist on the movie The Mummy.
So, in fact, millions of animals were ritually slaughtered in ancient Egypt to foster a huge mummification industry that drove some species extinct. This was, you know, I kind of skipped a beat there, but this was following when they would kind of occasionally do it for pharaohs or the occasional sacred beast. I don't know if I got into that just now, but that was the other time that they would mummify the pets of the pharaoh or the occasional sacred beast, because they did think that all life was precious, like every animal had a significance. So during certain rituals, they would mummify certain animals. This later evolved. People, I guess, liked it. I didn't get the cultural change. I didn't find where it shifted, but eventually it just became huge. Like the whole industry blew up.
We need more of these.
Yeah. Well,
hippo mummies everywhere.
I think it was more of just the profession. I mean, everywhere that I read it, they use the term industry. And we, you know, you and I both found articles that, or sources rather, I should stop saying specifically articles, but sources that were, that kind of delineated the different services that a human could get. And I imagine that extended to animals. There was like tiers of mummification. Like there was like the luxury Cadillac version of mummification. And then there was like if you were poor, they just threw you in a salt bath version. Yeah. So there was a lot of money in it because everyone cared about how they made it into the afterlife. And I could see that translating into the animal mummification industry. Like there's only so many people, you know, you gotta open up those channels of revenue. You gotta bring in those other sources of income.
What do you think happened to the salt people that showed up in the afterlife?
The people that got salted?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to think about that. That's gross. That sucks.
When they believed that you arrived in the afterlife with your body intact, right? Mm-hmm. As long as you preserved it well. And so salt is just another means to the same end. So,
but you show up as like jerky. Like all jokes aside, like the other versions, you know, the top tier, they gutted you because it made you the easiest to preserve. They turned you in like a husk. And I think that ended up, you like look the most like yourself because they had to use the least amount of like chemicals to stop the decomposition of your innards. And then the second tier, they kind of injected you with a bunch of chemicals and spices, not chemicals. I don't think they had like labs, but things that they knew would slow the petrification of your innards. And then the third was they turned you into jerky.
Some people like jerky.
Maybe it's like, it's like a club and there's like a room for the jerky people. There's like a special place in heaven for the jerky people.
That would make sense that there was some kind of capitalist class,
yeah,
system.
Classism exists even in the afterworld.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would make sense. I would be simultaneously disappointed and not surprised at the same time.
Sorry, socialists.
You're getting turned into jerky.
The taxidermy industry, it eventually, this, you know, we're getting a little off topic. We're back to animals. This would go from the occasional sacred animal and pharaoh's pets to see to it that most animals in ancient Egypt would eventually have to endure a very short and miserable life. Basically, how this evolved is various gods had different animal totems or avatars. So those who maintained temples of each respective god, it started off as they would occasionally offer a service where people could bring the animal associated to the god. The priest would slaughter it, mummify it, stage it in the catacomb in their name. So it's like an offering to the god. But then the practice kind of reached like a zenith from about 650 BC to 280, where literally millions of animals, like dogs and cats, were raised by the temples. And then you could go and pick one out, like a really dark, like Build-A-Bear. And then the priest would slaughter and mummify that animal, put it in the catacomb in your name, or probably just chuck it off a fucking cliff. I mean, whatever. It's. I think they knew.
No.
They knew. They knew it was bullshit. And
no, because then that would smash up all the, all you know, all the aesthetic features that you're trying to preserve.
Yeah, but once the people, they're not going into the catacombs with them to see to it that it's put in the catacombs. They just, they probably just take the cat and throw the cat off the cliff. They probably don't even mummify it. No, that's not totally true. I'm kind of being salacious. That we know this because we found millions of mummified cats and dogs.
Which I think is funny to imagine an afterlife just filled with all these ghost cats.
Yeah, but of all the animals corralled for mummification carnage, kittens actually were the preferred choice, to kind of staying on brand here, preferred choice as they could fit into the mummy containers the most easily. Researchers estimate that millions of cat mummies were produced annually when animal mummifications was at its peak in Egypt. I don't have the dates for when the peak was. I don't think anyone at home cares, but there was a range of time where it was millions of kittens were salt bathed.
As long as it wasn't Garfield.
Mondays, right?
Yeah, that would be a hell of a Monday.
Also, whichever god is associated with kittens is kind of a dick.
Her name is Bastet.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is that real?
Bastet, the crazy Egyptian cat lady.
I'm glad you did.
With 1,000 ghost cats.
Now I don't know if I believe you or not.
I'm serious.
Oh, all right. Well,
that was her name. I don't know if she had 1,000 ghost cats.
She did.
Well, yeah.
Eventually she did. She had more than 1,000.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about this whole deal is that in regards to Egyptian mummification is that humans were also pretty much treated on the same tier, relatively the same amount of reverence as animals, because their lives were viewed as being of the same value on the cosmic scale. So there were these weird kitten mills that they were, but they were probably doing pretty much the same thing to humans. I don't know.
I think we could just call them chop shops.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It feels right.
I simultaneously love and hate that term at the same time.
You're supposed to.
Yeah. So animals were mummified with the same sophistication as their human counterparts. Now, animals, again, were culled much earlier, obviously, than humans. I'm suspecting they waited for the humans to die of other reasons.
Not always.
Reasons.
I don't know. Yeah, I know a little bit about, we don't have to go into it, but, sometimes they killed the pharaohs before they were supposed, It's like a power vacuum stuff.
Because they would make a great looking mummy, huh?
That's how they sold it to them. I'm sure that's how that line was fed once or twice. We are able to determine this now retrospectively as archaeologists find all these mummified animals. And there's more on that later about kind of what we've been finding, but more, but specifically to taxidermy, it's a lot. They use the same techniques more or less. Animals like the sacred ibis and baboons, although I didn't know which kind of baboons, because I thought baboons were still around.
What do you mean they were still around?
Like now, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, so it said baboons in the source that I read, but it didn't say which kind of baboon. But they were mummified in the millions because they were very sacred to Thoth, the god of wisdom and writing. We covered Thoth, actually, on Dice. Go give that a listen.
Probably because of the red butts.
Oh, actually, I think we covered Thoth in the Dirty Bits.
Yeah.
Go listen to both. But they were so popular and they sacrificed so many. Yeah, not us. We didn't do it. But we as humans did. That they went extinct, which gave rise to a fringe market of fake mummies, revealed only by recently by modern CT scans that archaeologists did. So basically, once the source of ibis and baboons ran out, these Egyptian taxidermists would use other animals to construct them, like some ancient Joseph Mengele type shit.
Hey! This one's just full of candy.
That's a pinata, sir.
What kind of, that is a pinata.
Yep.
Is a pinata taxidermy for paper?
At this store, we'll do it.
I'm sold.
Yeah.
Sold. I want a hippo. I want a hippo pinata for my
birthday.
We're
out of hippos, but...
I'm being serious right now.
But we mostly do people.
Hey, look. I'm just going to...
They have to come dead, sir.
Look, just hear me out.
We don't do that.
He's having real trouble in school. I can't keep
That's
him.
Not a solution. We're not here for that.
He would be much nicer if he was filled with candy. That's all I'm saying.
You could fill him with candy. You could give him candy.
Yeah, but
you want to eat candy out of your son, is what you're saying.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, but you were thinking. You were thinking it.
Your words. Goodbye.
Get out of my store. I'm leaving. Get out of my store.
Goodbye.
So there were also victual mummies, which were mummified animals that were intended to be used as a food source for the dead in the afterlife, which brings up an interesting thing in my head that I thought of if the afterlife is forever, you would eventually just run out of food. Like, they couldn't possibly bury enough animals with you. So is there, if you have to eat in the afterlife, do you have a shelf life in the afterlife when you run out of food?
I guess they had to eat. That was a thing?
Yeah, that's implied. This implies the need to eat in the afterlife. The existence of victual mummies implies the need of food and nourishment in the afterlife, unless it's for fun.
I thought when I was reading this, I thought you meant just food for people who are alive.
Nope. That's what No. These were like offerings to the dead.
Okay.
These animals were prepared by dehydrating the meat and wrapping them in linen bandages, which also implies that the other mummies, from what I can gather, weren't like, that's kind of an important segue into taxidermy, as we'll get into. The bridge from ancient Egypt to today is strong, but it is a little all over the place. But the only animals that were wrapped in the bandages, like the classic vision of the mummy, were the victual ones. The ones that weren't meant for eating weren't wrapped. So they were just kind of early, really ugly taxidermized animals.
Well, how are you going to eat something without a stomach? Checkmate, Egyptians.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Think about that.
They were really...
They must have known. There's... I don't know. We don't have to go into it.
Yeah, there's a
There's flaws in this.
There's a lot of holes in there, but
after.
So as far as the method, interestingly enough, they basically mummified these animals the same way that they preserved humans, as Baron said earlier, just without the bandages, unless they were victual animals, I guess.
So I want to share something that I found that I thought was influential, perhaps, to even modern taxidermy when we're talking about how the ancient Egyptians influenced taxidermy leading up to now. Because if you look in all the research, in all the papers, Sam and I even had a little argument about this.
Our lovers quarrel.
Yes.
As we do every episode.
Yeah, we have to. Did the Egyptians or did they not influence taxidermy? Right? So obviously they did, all the taxidermists.
Yeah, some would argue with research. You. Some would say that they didn't.
Anyway, so I looked into it and I tried to find some cultural context here. So in 1798, Napoleon invades Egypt, which prompts the first volumes of La Description d'Egypte, which was published several years later in 1809 by the collaborative efforts of over 150 scholars and artists that traveled with Napoleon to Egypt.
So he like generated this big effort to basically spread what he was finding in Egypt.
It was, hey, are you people, go draw stuff in Egypt.
Le Egypte.
Make a description for me.
For where?
I believe that's a direct quote. So, well, but what this does is it floods the market with Egyptian imagery, which to many at the time must have been shockingly fascinating, particularly the Egyptians' obsession with death and bodily preservation.
Because back then they were just chucking bodies like into ditches, right?
For the most part.
During the Napoleonic Wars and stuff.
You have to listen
to our coffin episode. Yeah, that's coffin going episode. Way back.
Yeah.
Yeah, we used to not care nearly as much as the Egyptians. It's like maintenance of the dead dropped off severely, I think, after Rome.
Maybe even in Rome.
Maybe, yeah,
depending on who you were in Rome.
Really, historically, it always came down how much money you had.
Yeah.
They say you can't be buried with it, but it sure shit affects how you're buried.
So in 1822, the Rosetta Stone is discovered, allowing for translation of Egyptian writing. In the context of viewing this from the standpoint of a person involved in the scholarly community, the stretch of time must have passed through like a fad, and there were very few circles that you couldn't get into scientifically that weren't talking about the recent discoveries of ancient Egypt. Hey, did you see that mummy?
Don't talk to
that hippo mummy. It's much smaller than you would think. Of course, when talking about Egypt, you're going to be talking about mummies, and that leads to a pervasive influence on the art of skin preservation and taxidermy. Taxidermists today still cite Egypt, as we've talked about, as being the paterfamilias of the art. And that begs the question for me, does it all devolve down to some kind of morbid obsession we as humans have with death? Or is it pure preservation for education? I mean, obviously with the Egyptians, it wasn't. It was the afterlife, right? It was all about the afterlife.
Yeah, but that with that comes a pure preservation for education. Like, that drove them to want to discover better versions of preservation for the efforts of making it into the afterlife.
Yeah.
It can be both. Like, if you're talking about motivation, that's different. But if you boil it down objectively, it's both.
Do you think the Egyptians had school children come in and see how the mummification process was
done? I'd be willing to bet that the way that professions were modeled going back that far historically, you probably became an apprentice pretty young if that was the line of work that you were destined to fall into. I don't know if they were family businesses. Oh, you know what? Actually, you know what? Fuck me. I did read up on this. It was a sacred position, so you were appointed by the clergy, the Egyptian clergy, you know? So it was an appointed position. But all the same, I don't know at what age you were appointed, but given the average life expectancy back then, I wouldn't be surprised if it was you were pretty young. So they had kids, but no, I don't think I also don't think they had school the way you think that they had school.
Boy, you've turned 5 today. You know what that means. You're going to the mummy factory.
I get to gut the man.
Yeah, it's your birthday.
Yay! I've been really waiting to gut the man.
Don't forget to wrap the bandages real tight.
Oh, it's my second favorite part after scooping the brain. I can't wait to mummify you, Dad.
Won't be long now.
So as I mentioned about the dropping off of, how much we cared about our dead, besides ancient Egypt, society largely lost interest in taxidermy proper altogether. Barbarians, Romans, and the ancient Greeks, as well as Native American cultures, all indisputably had an interest in preserving animal skins and hides, which is related to taxidermy, but not really taxidermy. It's not what we're talking about. And the Middle Ages saw very little, if any, taxidermy for a number of reasons. Reason one, hides and furs are valuable. Reason two, meat is valuable. Reason three, bones are valuable. And truth be told, most castles and manors were quite cramped, and the Middle Ages were hard times, and things of value were very scarcely squandered unless you had immense wealth.
No room for hippo mummies.
No, you're for really fixated on the hippo mummies.
I love the hippo mummies.
More importantly, there was no room for... It would be a gigantic luxury to have this rotting, because at this point the technology wasn't there either to keep it really from rotting. A giant rotting animal in your, castle room? Your castle room.
Yeah, that's a place in a castle.
Castle room. Where you ate grog. The living room?
Sure.
Also, they didn't have the motivation the Egyptians had to preserve dead animals. There was no belief that offering your stuffed house cat to Jesus would somehow grease the palms of St. Peter, because now we are also in, we're in the AD. Christianity, Catholicism, whatever. They're all the Protestants. These are the prominent... Christianity is the prominent religion, and Christianity has no huge draw of sacrificing animals. Nor did they really see the animals as being sacred as the Egyptians either. They kind of were property. At best, noblemen wanted a trophy to show other noblemen what they had killed, which, referring back to the issue of limited space, actually, interestingly enough, resulted in the trend of simply sawing off the tops of the skulls of whatever horned beast they killed and hanging it on the wall.
Mm.
That started the trend of mounting antlers, actually. That started during the Middle Ages of noblemen to save space, but also it would be I killed this deer, and these are the horns of this deer. I am a man. And in the Americas is where we really started mounting the whole head. The European style is just the top of the skull with the antlers. The American style is to have the whole head.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which ironically has more in common with the motivations behind the development of practical taxidermy, which we're now getting to, whereas the actual practices of Egyptians are closer to the techniques, but farther from the motivation. So there's a bit of a switch 'em up here between practice and motivation, as we move forward. Taxidermy is a bit of a mixed bag of how it progressed forward.
To talk about this mixed bag a little bit more, in regards to our earlier conversation, were Egyptians the first taxidermists? Were they not?
Amadine.
Amadine?
Mm-hmm.
Amadine.
We read the same thing.
Pequignot.
This was a great source. I enjoyed this article, this book.
Pequignot.
I don't know how to say the
name. Amadine Pequignot. In the history of taxidermy.
Pequignot.
Okay. Pequignot.
Pequignot.
Amadine Pequignot.
He's French.
Thank you.
Go on.
I appreciate it.
Sorry.
You got anything else?
No. No, you're good.
Pequignot, in the history of taxidermy.
Doing a great job.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks. In the history of taxidermy, Clues for Preservation states that modern taxidermy, in the strictest sense, begins in the 16th century. So that is to say, referring to the preservation of an animal with some kind of intent to display it either for educational or artistic purposes. And there are few actual recorded journals of the how and the why of this, but we do have crocodile specimens dating back to 1597 hung in repose limbo for however long that they can be preserved that way.
I was trying to picture what that looks like.
You didn't see a picture? They got pictures.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because in repose...
Yeah, they're like floating crocodiles because they're suspended from the ceiling.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Well,
yeah.
Like repose in the art, like the classical painterly sense is like a woman kind of reclining like on a...
That's how I pictured it.
On a duvet
it, yeah.
Or something.
Yeah.
So like... when I read that, because again, we read the same thing. When I got to that part of the book, I was like, was this funny? Like, was this like...
I mean, it's kind of
a
funny.
Bunch of sexy crocodiles just in some nobleman's, like it was a laugh.
I guess maybe I misused the word, but I meant it in the sense that. Like,
oh, that's not right from the book.
No.
Oh, no, you no. Used repose.
Yeah.
So you pictured sexy crocodiles.
Well, I just pictured like repose is, you know, crocodiles being crocodiles. But
that I would not repose. Describe a crocodile as being in repose at any point of its life. Skulking.
It's an infocast first.
You know, thrashing. These are things that crocodiles do. They don't repose.
They're very calm and collected, and they're just sailing around in the water, just lounging around, you know?
I challenge you.
Except they're flying through the air.
Find some reposing crocodile. I also don't know if that's the proper way to use it in, like, the current...
Is it a verb? I liked the word.
I don't think it's a verb. And I did find from the same source an even earlier specimen that you may have missed because they don't really use it as an actual instance. And personally, again, like if I'm going to throw my hat into this ring of historians, if I may, yeah. I don't think any of these are actual proper. Like if it seems like everyone has beef with who were the first taxidermists based on the criteria. And if you're not going to include the ancient Egyptians for philosophical purposes, and you're going to be strictly like objectively the technical approach, I don't think any of these 16th century specimens cut it either.
What is your justification?
Because they're basically skin puppets, and this is.
I mean,
the earlier one. So
taxidermy is. Kind of.
We're gonna get into it. We're gonna get into it. Yeah, at this point, exactly. So it's not.
Well, no. I mean, at the modern point, like
it is, but it isn't. There's more. We're gonna get into it.
Yeah.
But there's way more art intact today. This was, and this bison is the perfect example. There was a European bison that was processed by Baron von Herbenstein of Austria, who mounted the skin over a crude wooden frame for display in his residence somewhere before 1550.
Whack. Fake taxidermy.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't include it. And this guy doesn't really use it as his first instance of the 16th century.
Might as well be a blanket.
Because it's a murder puppet. It is like it's a lawn ornament with skin stretched over it. It's not I wouldn't count that as taxidermy.
Although
in the Egyptian sense or the modern sense.
Again,
this dude just made Halloween decorations with a dead bison.
It's hard for me because I was actually thinking about this specific instance when I was driving on the way up here to record and how we didn't consider it taxidermy. But now after the taxidermy videos that I saw today, I'd say it's closer, as close as the Egyptians. As close, in my opinion. Because it's all about just taking the skin and putting it on a form at this point. That's all they do in modern taxidermy. But at this point, taxidermy was not about the afterlife at all. It was specifically scientific, and it's not stated in the history books, but we could probably speculate that artists were using taxidermy specimens to create art around that time. That's not really here or there. That's just a little side note. So science was heavily wound up with the church. Aristotelian methods of natural philosophy collected from the Crusades had wound up through the cracks and crevices which formed this Frankenstein's monster of theology and science. And to put a panache on it, the general theory behind Aristotelian philosophy is that the qualities of nature can be observed and learned from, maybe not from a quantitative number sense, but at least from an empirical sense, which I took that to be like, just watch them, man. Just look at them. You'll learn something.
Yeah.
Which isn't that profound to me, but well, you know, I guess
it's quite profound to be able to freeze nature in time.
Sure, sure. In the taxidermy sense, yeah, but I don't think that's what Aristotle was talking about.
I think that actually contradicts some of what I read leads experts to dissuade enthusiasts from believing Egyptians were the first altogether because their motives were spiritually driven as opposed to driven by natural curiosity of nature. But you're saying that the origins of what we would call more practical taxidermy came from a conflation of the two, more or less, like a divine interest in observing nature is what I got from your Aristotelian.
Sort of. I would say that the church had more of a accidental influence on. I mean, of course.
Accidental taxidermy is a great phrase.
Well, what I mean is that the church, maybe you did. I didn't come across anything that specifically, like what we were talking about. The church wasn't. The Catholic Church wasn't into taxidermy. So if the church had any influence on taxidermy at the time, it was either in spite of it or through sources like the Crusades, which was religious fueled, which brought back these Aristotelian philosophies. Sure, there was definitely, like, every scientist, though, was a Catholic at the time.
Well, they had to say that they were.
What's that?
I mean, there's a through line of men of science of this time that had to just play along that didn't believe in God because you would be fucking killed.
Well, there's that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So we could get into that all day.
Yeah. Yeah. So to tie this all together, a philosophical scientific drive to learn through careful observation and study is what initially creates a need within the scholarly community to taxidermy. And the whipped cream on top of all this is that the Bible suggests that humans own everything and can do whatever the hell they want with it, which probably had something to do with it as well. People that grew up reading the Bible, they're thinking, you know, they're looking at every animal and they're being like, yeah, I could put that on a wooden frame if I wanted to. Why not?
Isn't there like
an
ideology with Christianity that like all of God's creatures are sacred? Like really serious Christians wouldn't like hurt a fly, let alone skin and mutilate a bison and stretch it over a wooden frame.
Well, now you're talking about contradictions within Christianity. But I know that there's definitely a passage in Genesis where God says, this is like to Adam, like, this is all your domain. Do eat it, have sex with it.
Right, which is why I skinned this buffalo and stretched it over this wooden frame. Because God said, do unto others what you would done unto yourself. Do you understand what I'm saying, boy?
Well, as a philosopher within the church, I can see that you are a Christian man, and I agree with your ideals, but I am not sure about these methods over here you have created.
It seems my point has gone right over your head. I'm asking you to skin me alive. For sexual reasons.
We'll have to...
So there is another motivation here that we haven't covered yet, and that is the forging of cryptids through taxidermy. Beginning as early as the 16th century, travelers and taxidermy enthusiasts used their tools of the trade to bring magnificent beasts to life. And these beasts were known as Jenny Hanovers. Sometimes also called devilfish, Jenny Hanovers were taxidermied rays, skates, or guitarfish. The broad, flattened creatures were then heavily altered and desecrated to create a gruesome basilisk demon or dragon. Usually the nostrils and mouth located on the underside of the animal were positioned into a face of a fake creature. Then various parts were clipped or cinched or, you know, basically reshaped to create the impression of wings, legs, and monstrous appendages. Basically, these were like, you know, I'm going to narrow our audience here down, but they were the dittos of the animal kingdom, it seems. And they could just turn them into whatever they wanted. Like, they're these blank slates that just are, you can dredge up off the bottom of the sea and turn into demons. Jennies were made and peddled by sailors and snake oil salesmen. And the Swiss scholar and naturalist Conrad Jesner described how to make a dragon out of a dried ray in his 1558 Encyclopedia of Fishes. He also warned, ordinary people are very much impressed with these things, which I think was meant to imply that a lot of people got fooled into thinking that these things were real. And his encyclopedia also goes into like a 10 paragraph or 10 sentence description on how to make one, because he was in like an oddity shore in some port. I think it was in Norway. And he saw one and he like called out the purveyor immediately. He was like, "Hey man, I'm a naturalist. You know the deal. That's not a fucking devilfish, but I want to know how you made it." And it turns out how they made it was basically how I just described. And then they put it in a basin of salt posed in the position that they wanted it to be in. And if you really want to get freaked out, look up devilfish or the Jennies, like, which also that name isn't over, like it's not specifically from anyone in particular. But
they were the first Legos, basically.
They were the first Legos, yes. that is devilfish, yeah.
Oh, it looks very nice. It looks, I.
It's not nice, it's spooky.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's spooky. Yeah, I'm real spooked out. Yeah.
But, do you want to buy devilfish?
How much are we talking about here?
How much you got?
Not much. I got a couple pieces of corn in my pocket.
I can't sell you devil.
Can I have the devil fish?
Why did you come to my store with corn?
It looks exactly like my wife.
Gross.
Can I buy it?
No, not with corn. This is all to say, I think, along with the possibility, spiritual motivations, it was largely an extension of our desire to control nature, as we have always strived to and continue to strive to do. Whether it be to create displays solely for the duty to educate others or to fool a bunch of others, like yuppies and the like, into buying desecrated stingray corpses. Taxidermy is yet another notch in our bedpost of how we can assert our dominance in ways that are deranged and unnatural over nature.
I take affront to the phrase "a notch in your bedpost" when referring to taxidermy, sir. Just putting that out there. So as we can see, science leading up to the Renaissance and the Age of Enlightenment in regards to taxidermy and a lot of other things was still trying to find its sawdust-filled feet down on the mount. And to bring it all around, the late Renaissance was a busy tidal pool of influence that all had an effect on taxidermy. Trade routes to Asia were open and bustling. New world colonization was fully underway, and Greek humanism was being debated by scholar artists.
By the way, also before we go any further, I do just want to like put a visual to this because this is a largely visual topic. At this point, taxidermy was still largely underdeveloped. And these things did not look right. Early taxidermists stuffed mounts with sawdust and rags, which sometimes disfigured them. And one of the principal substances for preservation was arsenic, which was mainly used to repel insects. But in fact, arsenical soap was the key player in taxidermy until 1980s in some places. So this was very pervasive in the industry. And by the way, A lethal dose of arsenic in adults is between 140 and 1400 milligrams, and a recipe that I found for arsenical soap from the 18th century called for 320 grams, which is about 228 times the lethal dose.
I don't understand what the problem is, Sam. It's just stuffed animals that are time bombs filled with arsenic waiting to kill somebody. Hey, look, you kill an animal, maybe the animal kills you after it's dead.
Yeah,
it seems like it's karma, you know?
I guess the reason I put that in there, I did think it was pretty important. Or beyond just being interesting, I thought it was interesting, but it is important because that was like the lengths we would go to just to assert this dominance, like that I was talking about earlier. Like, we smeared and dipped these things in poison. We stuffed them with whatever we had around. The whole thing's so unnatural at this point. I mean, we'd strive more to make it look more natural and untouched by man later. But at this point, it's kind of hard to avoid that appearance.
Yeah, when you said that they were all stuffed with rags and sometimes looked uneven, I just pictured this lumpy, like, dog.
Yeah, if you look up online, any images that are around of taxidermy that have survived from the 17th and 18th century, they're mortifying. It's nightmare fuel. It is an abomination.
Well, regardless of how fuckable these things looked, nobles still paid good money for exotic artifacts around the globe. And soon you have the accumulations of collections of curiosities filled with these stuffed and mounted animals from far off lands. And these people who could afford to have them would grab at relics taken by enterprising sailors from around the globe, taken, also known as OPP. Throughout the Renaissance, wonder rooms and cabinets of curiosity were on the rise as a way for rich people to show off their cool shit, seldomly in the name of scientific pursuit, but usually because they just wanted to show off their cool shit. These collections, scrounged up by nobility, were then gradually donated to educational institutions at the time, which would set the basis for museums.
Seemingly more and more often, as our fascination and desire to learn more about the mysteries of nature evolved, we began to see the value of being able to study taxidermized animals. Slowly, there was a shift from these objects being curiosities and relics from abroad to specimens and studies of natural science. One British naturalist, Captain Thomas Brown, made the practical observation that mounted animal specimens allow the naturalist to, quote,
contemplate without dread the most destructive and furious quadrupeds and the most noxious reptiles.
In fact, many dangerous and rare specimens may not have been ever studied if not for taxidermy, and that is, you know, pretty accurate for even up till today. Naturally, the development of large natural history collections would not have been possible without a means of preserving specimens for a long term. And early collectors and naturalists quickly realized proper taxidermy techniques were necessary to ensure that museum collections did not degrade and disintegrate over time. And thus, a significant part of the study of natural history is hopelessly intertwined with the rather unnatural history of taxidermy. And that is where we will pick back up next week on InfoCast 5000, where we'll be focusing on the Renaissance of taxidermy and the taxidermy boom of the 19th century.
Ooh, it's going to get real weird. Buckle in.
It's genocide-y for animals.
What's that? What's that, Calvin and Hobbes?
The one where he skins and stuffs no, Hobbes?
No, no. But there's this Calvin and Hobbes strip. Jesus Christ. There's a Calvin and Hobbes strip where Calvin is chasing a butterfly and he catches it. And then Hobbes says something like humans would bottle up a rainbow and capture a rainbow if they could. So that's basically, I think, it's the same energy with taxidermy is where I'm going with that, I think.
Skin a rainbow. I'd stuff a rainbow and mount it in my living room. Did I ever tell you how I got fired from the museum?
No.
One day I was tasked with mounting a raccoon. And you know what I did? I didn't use the wooden mount that they gave me, and I just put the raccoon over my hand. And then I became the mold.
Well, Gerald.
Good old Gerald became the mold.
It's been a great interview, but I think we're going to.
When I invented what I call raccoon girlfriend. You see, well, I don't have to explain to you how raccoon girlfriend works. You want me to show you?
Thank you for applying for our investment firm. We're going to go a different direction, I think, but it was great to meet you. We might have security escort you out.
Do you validate parking?
No.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's all right, because I didn't drive here anyway. I took the bus.
Yeah, that's it for Taxidermy Part 1. Buckle in, because Morbid's the name of the game right now, and we're going to have a great time doing it.
Yeah, I am genuinely looking forward to next week. It's going to
be fun. Yeah. We got some fun stuff coming up.
We're going to talk about Carl Ackley, which is single-handedly killed the most animals than any other human being on the planet. And we're going to talk about the evolution of museums, and we're going to get a little bit more into what taxidermy actually looks like today.
Hey, I've got a couple of things for everybody out there. If you would all do us a favor, if you're out there listening, if you're a first-time listener, if you're a second-time listener, and you're listening through Apple iTunes, would you, by chance, give us a nice rating on the App Store? We don't talk about this enough, but it would really help us getting some more listeners, and that would be amazing, and people would talk about us.
And I have a request that if you are listening and you're enjoying it, please tell one of your friends.
Please. Yeah, that too.
Please tell one of your friends. Convince one of your friends, not your favorite friend. What I would call an expendable friend. A burner friend, if you will. Yeah, so if you guys wouldn't mind plugging our podcast for us, that'd be great.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. Agreed. And we also, if you have anything that you want to add or anything you want to talk to me about, your hopes and dreams or favorite stroganoff recipes or whatever, just email me at infocast5000@gmail.com. And I think
you can find me on infocast5000 at Instagram.
Yeah.
On Instagram. I'm on Instagram, where I will be revealing all the secrets of Raccoon Girlfriend.
I am on Instagram, too. I'll be lurking.
Yeah, anyone that's in the comments enough has figured out how to find Baron.
I'll find you first.
He doesn't make his presence very secret.
I'll find you first.
And there's a website coming soon.
There's a website coming up. I don't know what's going to be on it yet.
Possibly t-shirts.
Stuff. Yeah, possibly t-shirts. We don't know.
And,
whatever you want.
Koozies and air fresheners.
Yeah, you can get one of those, like a Halloween mask, but it's Sam's beard.
I'm gonna sign off now. This is me signing off.
Bye.
Bye, guys.